Okay, podcasting softly listeners, this is your friendly neighborhood Kent Hill coming to you today with a wonderful, I've received a wonderful gift. And the wonderful gift is something that I've often dreamed, either if I got the chance to do it myself or at least someone did it, and that was make a behind the scenes documentary of the making of Waterworld. My guest is none other than the very talented man behind Ballyhoo, which is Daniel Griffith. He's the maker of various supplementary material of some, oddly enough, a lot of the films that I really love. Gorgo, Lawnmower Man, Remo Williams, This Island Earth, Red Scorpion. Very excellent documentary. High Noon at the End of the Universe, The Making of Metal Storm, another film that I love. A Mystery Science Theater 3000, he's done supplementary work for them, and coming, hopefully it's coming, Celluloid Wizards of the Video Wasteland, but we're here to talk about Maelstrom, the Odyssey of Waterworld. Daniel, thank you for being on Podcasting Softly.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Mate, it is absolutely incredible. I could just say incredible for the entire duration. People will probably get sick of hearing incredible come out of my mouth, but it is incredible. If you're a fan of this film, this is the documentary you have been waiting to see, ladies and gentlemen. It's part of a wonderful package with all three versions of the film, a wonderful booklet with my other guest, who, if you are looking at the page on the website, you'll see my other guest was David J. Moore, who helped write some stuff for the supplementary material with Daniel. And Daniel Maelstrom, it is a dream come true for fans of Waterworld. Tell us about your first encounter with, like, your first encounter with Waterworld, period.
Sure, yeah. Well, I was in high school, basically in 95, that was my graduation year, so that summer, you know, really meant a lot to me. And for the past 2 years prior to graduating, I was a projectionist at a movie theater at a local multiplex, and I followed film all my life, but certainly when I was working at a theater, getting to, you know, build the prints, decide what trailers go on each print, etc., it was really a dream job. And, you know, I would read and keep up with different films that were in development. And I read a lot about Waterworld. Never really knew exactly what to make of it until I was building the print for Street Fighter, which came out the holiday of 94 and is a Universal picture. And attached to the print was the teaser trailer for Waterworld. And so we screened the prints, you know, after closing on Thursday, or in this case, this was a Wednesday opening. So, you know, we started up the projector, watched the trailers, and then it came to the Waterworld trailer. And at the end of that trailer, really my mind was blown, because I was a huge Mad Max fan, and I, was also a fan of Kevin Reynolds. I had just recently been exposed to Rapa Nui, which I thought was really a masterpiece. It was a brilliant film. And, of course, I loved Fandango and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And I was a pretty big Kevin Costner fan. But I thought this was just amazing. And from that moment on, you know, I followed just about any and every, you know, magazine, periodical that I could track down in my, you know, hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Just kind of following the trajectory of this film, what's going on with this film. And I think then I was really exposed to, like everyone, all the negative press. And it just made me more excited to see the film. But, you know, I guess a lot of other people probably thought, you know, this is going to be a flop. Just this really ambitious disaster piece. And so I was in love with it. I always got kidded by everyone I worked with. You know, they would all joke, you know, when the standee for Waterworld came in, I wanted to be the one that made, you know, built it and put it up in the lobby, and I did a big promotion in conjunction with a local car dealership and a local radio station, and Universal provided the t-shirts and soundtracks and posters and all kinds of stuff for Waterworld, and I transformed the theater lobby into an atoll. Spent really, I would say, a couple of months prior to the release, you know, we were saved all these cardboard boxes because, you know, in the movie theater you have boxes for everything, and saved these cardboard boxes, and I used that as kind of the surface, and then kind of textured that to make it look like pieces of metal, pieces of wood, people, you know, things like that, and, you know, build this atoll wall that you entered into the theater, and then, you know, inside the lobby had all these different, like, catwalks and bridges going across, you know, over your head, and things of that nature. It was pretty wild, but, you know, really from the beginning, before I even saw the film, I was fascinated with it, and then when I saw the film, I was, you know, completely blown away. I was very happy with how it turned out, because to me, I thought it was a very successful film in what it was trying to do. It was a action adventure. It was Mad Max on water. But you know, a lot of people kind of walked away with mixed feelings. And but I think from that time period in my life, I think I was really interested in the possibility of one day being able to tell the story of Waterworld, and it really would have to be done, you know, when the tide has settled back and everyone has kind of, you know, moved on with their life and separated themselves just a little bit from the experience.
Right. Yeah.
So it was, you know, from that point, I mean, that's when I was exposed. I mean, there's some stories about, you know, me attempting through my connections with different, boutique distribution companies and independent distribution companies that had partnerships with Universal. I've been trying to get them, you know, on board with the idea of doing a special edition of Waterworld. And, I think there was a period where I thought Shout Factory may go after it. And then, you know, through my relationship with Arrow, I'd just come off of doing the Thing documentary for them, for their restoration of that film. And they had thrown out a couple of titles that they were potentially going to distribute. And one of them was Waterworld. And I immediately was like, I want to do Waterworld. And I think at that time, a different producer was attached to it. And I think from there I was kind of, well, I'm disappointed, that sucks, you know, because this was like my opportunity to do one of my 10 dream projects as far as documenting the making of a film. And Waterworld was in my top 10 of the movies I wanted to create documentaries for. And I think from that moment I kind of moved on to other things, but about a month later they sent an email saying, our producer can't really get anywhere. Do you want to take a crack at it? And I did.
Oh, gee, let me think.
So.
That's great.
Yeah, but that was kind of how I got attached to doing the features for this release.
Right.
But my exposure to the film, you know, was really early on, senior year of high school.
Well, a lot of parallels there, I have to say. Daniel, I too was a senior in high school, and I was a projectionist at the local theater. Unlike a lot of people, though, I didn't, at the time, I still try to now. It's very difficult, more so now than it was then, to avoid any press or anything leading up to a movie. So coming into Waterworld, for me, was very much a, you know, I like I said, I used to try and not look at and listen, or, read any of the, if there was negative press or positive press or anything like that. I liked when I was a kid, just, the only time you knew a movie was coming out is you saw the poster outside the theater. And that was the only thing you knew about it. And that poster said it all. And you were like, I want to see that, right? And that was with Waterworld. So I go into Waterworld, absolutely blown away. Ironically, I saw it with my family. My mother hates the film with a passion. She was lost the moment Costner pissed in a cup and drank it.
Wow.
So
she had a long 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah, go. Yeah. So that, I mean, my resounding memory is I was one of the only people in the theater that was absolutely blown away. To my mother's disdain for the movie to this day, even when I told her about, I said, there's this great release, I'm going to try and talk to these people who are part of this release. I'm not that bloody Waterworld movie. You still like that rubbish? And I said, Mum, I don't like that rubbish. I love it. I absolutely love it. I think it's fantastic. And so anyway, it was only after seeing the film for the first time, of course, like yourself, I wanted to know more, because we were starting to get to the, I bought all the toys, I bought the novelizations, the board game, the video game, the soundtrack, all that sort of stuff. Got all the Waterworld I could get, the comic books, all that sort of stuff. And I was just like, oh, man. But because I was into movies like yourself, and I was... loved any sort of behind-the-scenes documentary that existed. As you know, back in that time, there wasn't, DVDs were just sort of coming in, and behind-the-scenes features and all that wasn't... Prior to that, it didn't really exist,
Right.
It was very rare that there'd be a behind-the-scenes little thing on a video or all that sort of thing. And usually it was only like a special edition video that had like one of those little, sort of stock standard electric press kit sort of documentaries where you've got talking heads and a few shots and behind the scene and then the trailer and that was sort of it. It wasn't really comprehensive, you'd say. But it was in the wake, of course, of seeing the film that, of course, I came across all of the things which I was very pleased in a lot of ways to learn were most... bullshit. For instance, there is a book I've got here. It came up some years back. It's by a gentleman named James Robert Parrish. It's called Fiasco. It's not purely about Waterworld. It's about sort of every great Hollywood fiasco there's been, for likes of Cleopatra, Ishtar, Popeye, different things like that. But in his writing of Waterworld here, I remember reading this when I got the book here. It says, the film's central set piece is a sprawling metal atoll, about a quarter of a mile long, made of well over 1,000 tons of steel, ended up costing an unanticipated $5 million, and at one point, the lengthy chute actually sank and had to be retrieved. Right? So that's on the record in this book, so... thankfully, this sort of rubbish has been dispelled. Among the other stories, of course, there's over-escalating water of budget to $175 million, where the stars had land accommodations of rooms that were $1,800 a night, an $800,000 yacht was acquired to ferry Costner from the island to the set, a mere 400 yards from where he was staying. It cost $400,000 to raise the set that sunk, So that's the kind of crap that was out there. But I'm very, very pleased to report, listeners, that a lot of that rubbish really was sniping. And, of course, the set sinking is, as it turns out, bullshit. So, that was the kind of stuff that was floating around this movie. And as your film depicts... they really had it in for this movie before it had even come out, right?
Right. Well, and it's a it's an interesting thing because, you know, we live in a climate, especially here in the States, of, you know, because of our political regime, the idea of like fake news and stuff like that. And it's kind of interesting in doing this project. Like, well, this is sort of an instance where, you know, news had an agenda, and the agenda was to tear something down. And you know, kind of, you know, through conversation, not necessarily through interviews, but through conversation with some of the principal people involved, you know, that stemmed from a lot of things. But you know, there are instances where you have, you know, you have like an actor like Costner of his stature at that time, you know, one of the, if not the, you know, biggest, you know, star, certainly the biggest name you could put on a poster. You know, he had come off of success with Dances with Wolves, where, I mean, he pretty much, you know, not only acted in, but starred in, produced, he directed it, all this stuff. So he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. There were things going on personally in his life that he was coming under attack with. And I feel like, and just like the people involved with the film, they quickly deduced that it's, the press were interested in knocking that, you know, that chip off his shoulder. And it also comes from a lot of really, I would say, you know, reporting information that they got that wasn't necessarily true or was out of context, certainly with the original budget of the film. As people will learn watching the documentary, the film really began as a B-movie, I mean, a low-budget B-movie that would be done for New World, Roger Corman's company.
Yeah.
And so it was in kind of the wake of the Mad Max fandom. Certainly in the industry, there was, you know, a lot of different independent companies that realized, hey, you know, making a post-apocalyptic movie could be cheap and it could be marketable if done the right way, and it's coming off of the success of, you know, Road Warrior. And I think that was kind of the genesis. And so the budget that was originally attached to the film was small, and it went through a couple of different producers, through different companies, and before it ended up with the Gordons. And I think from there, you know, the budget grew a little bit, but it was still not as big. And then once Kevin Costner came on board, you know, the budget went up really high because, you know, Universal knew that having Kevin Costner involved would mean more success. Certainly would mean something that's more marketable. And I think everyone set out to make a big movie. It wasn't like they were shocked. No one was shocked that this was going to be a really expensive movie. They knew it was going to be an expensive movie. They knew that the cost might, you know, might get a little out of hand, but they anticipated it. The studio anticipated it. So it wasn't an instance where the movie was out of control. It wasn't like Heaven's Gate, where you had, you know, a filmmaker kind of holding a studio hostage to make his vision a reality.
Right,
this was different. It was a different situation, and I think, you know, my interest in the film was to be fair to it. I felt that even if the stories were true, let's say I set out to document this and find out that everything is true, I still wanted to be fair to the film because I felt that the movie deserved that much. So anyone that's familiar with filmmaking would know, A, filming on water would be costly, but also if you just look at the movie, while it looks like a bunch of, you know, a bunch of rubbish just kind of, you know, sewn together and everything. I mean, you know, while it is junk, it's really, I mean, it's from an engineering standpoint, just the atoll itself is ingenious. The concept of it and, everything. It's just, I mean, it's really, I mean, I think it had a lot of big ideas, and I think those big ideas, certainly pairing that with, with water, shooting out in water, it's just, it's what added to, the escalating budget.
Yeah, sure. I've come under fire several times for saying this, and I'm going to say it again because I don't care. I compare Waterworld, put it up there with Jaws, as one of the great adventure pictures, and people say, well, how can you do that? And I say, well, quite simply, not purely because they're based on the water, or a lot of them are on the water, but... in the same respect that Jaws was essentially one of the first, what you would say is a big budget B movie, right?
Right.
Okay, and Waterworld I class as the same thing. Really, I mean, looking at the origins, like it was going to be a Corman picture or a low, like the early Mad Max was a low budget independent movie, and let's face it, all of after the Road Warrior, all of the pretenders, like a lot of the European ones, were reasonably low budget. They didn't have what you would call great production values, except they would have spent most of their money on getting the vehicles, mainly. You know, all those working vehicles. So, you have now, again, what is essentially a very big budget B movie, simply because of the genre that it's in. But like Jaws, because it has big stars, there is such care and attention and marvelous filmmaking crew behind it. You have what is essentially a B movie concept being made, with the most expensive magic box on the planet, so it's absolutely just when I heard about the concept, I mean, just the concept. I mean, I'm Australian, just in case you can't tell by my accent. But Mad Max is like church here, right? Mad Max, the Road Warrior, George Miller's, Dr. George, God love him, Fury Road, Beyond Thunderdome. We're Mad Max country out here. So the idea of a Mad Max on water For this moviegoer, folks, was absolutely, that's incredible. Yeah, why not? Yeah. Because it's a different kind of apocalypse. It's not a wasteland. It's not an industrial, some sort of city in ruins. It's not, the barren, dry, harsh, stark, all that sort of stuff, that we're used to. It's a world submerged, or as they say in the film, it wasn't created in a deluge, it was covered by it. And the wasteland is beneath, as he says, beneath our keel. So it was an absolute, this is incredible. Look at the scope and the scale of this thing. And you've got, big stars. You've got Hopper, you've got Costner, you've got Michael Jetta, who's fantastic. I forget the chappy's name who plays the Drifter, the guy with the paper. I forget his name. What's his name?
You broke up on the end of that. What was the...
Sorry, the chap who plays the Drifter in the movie, he's a wonderful actor. The bloke with the paper.
Yeah, yes.
I forget his name. I'll have to...
Yeah,
but, people listening, there's no such thing as not for sale, he's wonderful. Forgive me, whoever he is, I can't think of your name offhand. But anyway, yeah, wonderful cast, wonderful crew, wonderful director,
Just to clear that up, it was Kim Coates. It was the guy
Kim Coates, there you go. So we're fixed up. Thanks for that, mate. But yeah, I mean, this is incredible. And I'm so glad that this documentary now exists. This is a documentary I've been waiting to see. I love, I'm an absolute junkie for behind the scenes stuff. I've been very fortunate a couple of times to be an extra on a few big pictures that have been filmed here in Queensland. I wasn't an Aquaman, sorry to report, people, anyone who was... I haven't been an extra for a while. But, the whole what you might say is the nuts and bolts of filmmaking has always fascinated me. How do you, I mean, I know that, you know, and it's very clear from what you've said, people have heard you say, we're very passionate about Waterworld, you're very passionate about Waterworld, it's been your dream to do this documentary. Where do you start? Can you talk us through a little bit of the process? Like, where do you, you've got the passion, you've got the drive. What do you do? Like, how do you kick off something like this?
With Waterworld, I kind of came into it with enough knowledge and, accrued so much material throughout my life just being a fan of the film.
Right.
But I wasn't interested, like most of the projects I do, not really interested in making a fan documentary. I really kind of try to take that part of myself and put it aside and just really focus on being a visual storyteller, find the right components to tell, the best story possible, given time and budget restraint. Bonus features, you're not really dealing with a lot of, dealing with a huge budget, and you're not really able to have as much time as you would like. And in this case, there were other things going on in my life, personally, that made the production of this go a little longer than it probably should have. But I kind of held to the idea of I wanted to do something big, I wanted to do something that was a feature, and I think in the end, Arrow supported it, and they were just as interested as I am to make, or to create the ultimate release for the film. I kind of just start with, the key players and try to get them involved. And
right.
Sometimes that's not as easy as one might think. And I knew certain people I wanted to have involved from the beginning. I wanted Kevin Reynolds. I felt like he was, part of the backbone of the story. I thought that Chuck Gordon, because it was something that he was so passionately tied to, he was the backbone of the story. Some of the other producers, Peter Rader, the original screenwriter, I thought he was important to the backbone of the story because I wanted to not only talk about the making of Waterworld as we know it, but, to be able to properly illustrate the backstory of how this project began as a B feature and how it evolved and a lot of the changes that were made in that process. I thought people that were fans of the movie would be fascinated.
Sure.
With that.
I'll just jump in real quick. When I sort of fell into this, doing this, podcasting and softly gig a couple of years back, that was like my first thing I wanted to do. They said, I said, what do you want me to do? They said, you can do anything you want. And I, like you, I have a list of things, behind the scenes stuff I want to know about certain films, in my life. And right near the top of the list was Waterworld. And I, not really knowing how to go about getting people on at that time, I thought, what do? Do I call them? Do I email? How do I do that? Okay. So I literally just started looking on Facebook, and I think I found Peter Rader's Facebook page and wrote like this big passionate message, which he hasn't looked at, about how much I loved Waterworld. And I realized that there was a lot of stories, whether they be true or false. So he mightn't have had the best experience. But what I was chiefly interested in, and what you lucky bugger got to talk to him about was exactly that, was the genesis, not the eventual, after they sort of got, the thumbs up, but definitely prior to that, like him, where he got the inspiration, that wonderful bit of that wonderful sort of the first part of the documentary where it's just him talking about, they said, do one of these pictures. And so he's trying to think, well, how can I do that but make it new, and I'll do Mad Max on water. And it's just like, and that was incredible. That's something that I myself wanted to do. If Peter Rader ever hears this, check your Facebook messages because you've got a rather long one there from a very enthusiastic fan. If you still want to talk about it, I'm here. So it was really incredible. And like you said, everyone should know that Daniel told me that Kevin Reynolds actually was very pleased when you showed him the documentary.
Yes.
He was very pleased. Gave the thumbs up. So there you go. But Peter Rader and Dean Semler, I've had the very good fortune. I got to shake his hand once, but you got to talk to him a little bit longer than I did. How do you go about getting some of the bigger elements in these documentaries, like Kevin Reynolds, like Peter Rader? How does one do you do the long backwards and forwards game between agents and personal assistants and all that sort of thing?
That is the process, but you can do a little bit of detective work too. And I guess if I wasn't making documentaries, I guess I could be a detective, or at least a person that help people track down people. My grandmother was a genealogist, and she would write books about genealogy, and I spent a lot of time with her growing up, going to old libraries and cemeteries and stuff like that. And I think I think through helping her, she kind of taught me a little bit about following a paper trail and trying to find the right find the right connection or the right piece of information that would lead you to the person. Traditionally you begin with agents or reps, and if that turns up cold, or if for some reason they're no longer represented, and they don't know where the other representation is, and you can't find them, then you kind of have to go through other sources. So.
Mm. Yeah, but you accrued a marvelous group of people for the film. What is different in some cases, which is always, I think, and sometimes better, you're dealing more with the makers of the film, the writer, the director, production designer, costumes, the second AD, all that sort of stuff. The people that actually, it's fine that they interview actors for these documentaries sometimes, but actors, don't really talk and can't really talk about it unless they're an actor director or an actor producer or something. They can't really talk about the meat, the nuts and bolts of how the film, is going, because they're not there all the time when stuff's getting set up. They're off in their trailer doing something, playing Scrabble or whatever. But so it's great that the principals in this documentary are the filmmakers, the people that actually went through all the shit and fought the good fight to make sure that this film gets finished, and they're fighting, just as I thought it was great. I was waiting for someone to talk about how, I love how you got in touch with Steven Spielberg and what do you think about me making this movie? And he says, what was the answer? Don't, what should I do?
Right, right.
What advice can you give? Don't do it. Don't do it,
Right.
Because shooting, you know, as everyone knows the history of Jaws, I mean, what was it? They were supposed to shoot for like 44 days and end up shooting for 144 days or something like that. So it's absolutely nightmarish because everything is moving. I mean, you know, and anyone that's shot a film on the water, you know, a great Australian director I've also the privilege of talking to had the same problems doing his film Dead Calm, Phil Noyce, because everything is moving. Like, you set up the shot, and by the time you set up and everything's ready to go, the boat's shifted, you know, and the boat in the background shifted, and, you know, it's absolutely a nightmarish situation. And this, a movie of this scale and sets of this size, and they're out there, and it's a real working boats and jet skis, and like, for instance, in the scene where you'll see where all of the bullet hits had to be placed in these pipes underwater, and they have to, after every take, someone's got to go back out there and reset every single one of them, and then, you know, submerge it, and then get ready to do it again. I mean, that's, like, to think about, to bitch in the press about how much it's costing, yes, it's costing a lot of money, because they're not doing, you know, they're not making a Roger Corman picture out there, they're making it might be a B-movie subject, but they're doing it on a massive scale, you know? I mean, can you imagine what it would have been like to walk out onto that atoll set? I mean, there's no, you know, we can only imagine, there's no acting required, because you're there, you're in Waterworld, and it's there, you're standing on it, you know? It's absolutely, it's always awe-inspiring to me. I've had the privilege of being an extra on a few films. One in particular was No Escape, or Escapes from Absalom, as it was also released. That village, we were extras in the village battle sequence. Now, but that all was made. All those huts were real. All of the stuff that you see, that whole outsider's village there. Insider's village. Was all there. You know, they built everything. And, you know, so Waterworld comes, you could say, from, you know, that the last of that period where they actually built, you know, all these big full sets. Because you've got to, you know, we have to concede after that, you know, with the onset of films like Phantom Menace, where George said, well, look, we don't have to build the full thing. We just need to build a little bit of it, and we've got digital now, so we can just fill in the blanks with that, you know?
Right.
So we got the last of... With Waterworld, you really have a great example, and also a bit of a time capsule of again, the type of filmmaking, you know, of a certain scale that is sadly diminishing. I mean, as big as Aquaman, you know, a big billion-dollar making movie, as big as it looks on screen, if you were to walk onto the sets down there, I've seen some pictures, there's very little there. I mean, you wouldn't really, there's a lot of partial sets, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, so we're not talking about, you know, a massive set like the Atoll set, you know?
Right, and it is different. I think Waterworld, you know, kind of represents some of that, the last films of that era that was really a carryover from really the dawn of filmmaking.
Sure.
Where, you know, when there was scale, you tended to build that scale because you wanted that look. And with the exception of films that, you know, even before, you know, digital effects, I mean, you used or depended upon matte paintings and stuff to kind of fill in to make that scale seem even grander, but, you know, still, you know, they built huge sets, and it was lavish, and I think with Waterworld, it kind of harkens back to that style of filmmaking as a type of filmmaking that isn't really made anymore. I mean, if you look at the same period that Waterworld was released, you know, you had another film that took place on water that really bankrupted a company, or was the really was it the final nail in bankrupting a company? But he had Cutthroat Island, and that also was victim of A, shooting on water, and B, the scale of what they wanted to try to do. They wanted a pirate ship, but they wanted a big pirate ship. They wanted more than one, and they wanted to create this epic battle sequence that would rival things like Seahawk and stuff, but a lot of the early Earl Flynn or the Douglas Fairbanks pictures, and I think that they were looking at the same kind of thing where we want to show the scale and make this seem huge, and when you're seeing it on a big screen, it's just like, wow, look at the scope of this. But unfortunately with that picture, it really did fall flat. I think Waterworld has much more success and has certainly recouped its cost than Cutthroat Island. I'm not sure what the numbers are on Cutthroat Island, but I'm pretty sure it's still, pretty low.
Firmly the red. But another cool thing I can only imagine, hopefully one day I'll get to experience it, but I can only imagine getting everyone to supply you with like archival stuff like art and footage and photographs. Tell us what's that like, getting to delve into people's stuff that they supply to fill out the spaces in the documentary, like all that wonderful art and drawings and the archival interviews and stuff. Like, what's it like getting to look at all that stuff? Like, there's stuff, particularly stuff that you've never seen.
Well, film is a visual medium, and certainly, documentaries depend upon ways to illustrate the stories as they unfold. And as much as I research and make all the connections and come up with the questions and try to guide the narrative in post-production and do all the editing and everything else, I would be nowhere without the assistance of the people that were either involved or collectors, people that were very passionate about the film, that kind of, sought out material to just put in their own collection because they loved the film and wanted to preserve some aspect of its history. With Waterworld, everyone I interviewed, I asked if they had anything. And luckily, most of the people involved had stuff. And there was, this is also a situation where, you're operating under a certain time crunch. You can't really, spend a couple of years doing something like this because the whole reason for this existing is because there's a Blu-ray release coming out. So you're really locked into that schedule. So,
right.
There were other things that I probably could have been able to utilize if the timing, was on my side. If I had a year, to do the film or do the documentary or something like that, then I would have been able to deal with, someone saying, well, in my storage, I got a box of stuff, but I'm out in the UK filming a movie and I can't get to that. And when do you need it? Stuff like that. Things like that happen all the time.
Right.
So, with this, I was fortunate enough to get really a good amount of material, from Universal, from some of the people that participated, and then from, a few people that were just, really hardcore fans that happen to have access to stuff.
Yeah. That's cool. I mean, that would be like, Christmas morning, wouldn't it, looking through some of this stuff, particularly stuff that you hadn't seen or had no idea existed, and like particularly like production art and stuff like that, and that's got to be cool to like go through that stuff. Yeah,
it is, and it happens every once in a while in a project. You end up getting access to or discovering some piece of material, and you're like, wow, this is like the most amazing clip or the most amazing photo from this particular film, and it really does make you excited about the story that you're telling. I think, like, with the, you mentioned the Empire documentary, Cellular Lizards and the Video Wasteland, there's a couple instances in digging for material where I come across, behind the scenes, video footage that was shot by Charles Band on the set of Troll, and it's kind of like, oh, this is awesome, because you're seeing all this stuff going on with these effects and everything for Troll, and I've never seen this before. So there's little things like that where you're kind of like, wow, this is pretty neat.
That's awesome. Great stuff. There is an absence, people, like I said, I personally like to hear from the filmmakers. Most of the actors talking in the film is archival footage and photo footage. What was, because, like you said, there's a time limit with these types of films. Like, this isn't like Celluloid Wizards. This was more of something like you've wanted to do, and you've been given the chance to do it, but it's not like Celluloid Wizards in the respect, like, you have, time to, like you say, spend a year doing it. Was there a chance to even go after any of the actors for
any? Oh, yeah. I go after everyone. I mean, really, at the end of the day, I approach everyone.
Right.
Everyone, for any project I do, I try to get everyone involved. With Waterworld, it was more important to me because of what Waterworld is as a film. It's really a technical triumph, just as much as I think it is a fascinating action adventure film. It really is. It is ingenious in how all the components came together to make it possible. And so, to me, it was more important to interview the crew that were involved in just about every aspect of production. So you watch the documentary. I mean, how often do you see a documentary and here's the person that does the pyrotechnics, those people usually aren't asked to be involved in these kind of things. And to me, I thought that was so important. And it would be so fascinating to see how that was pulled off. I did approach the actors. I really, really tried several times to get Kevin Costner involved, and for various reasons that were never stated, he just declined. And I tried to get some of the other principals to participate, and no one really wanted to, or they all declined for one reason or another, but. To me, I felt like most of the people I approached, everyone was kind of hesitant as to what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. I had to really sell myself and sell my agenda with the documentary, and that was to tell a fair story that celebrated the film, and if there were negative aspects of the story, that I would handle them, but we would handle them truthfully. We wouldn't handle them with a certain amount of exploitation. We wouldn't be trying to sensationalize something, and we certainly wouldn't be trying to perpetuate the negative press that surrounds the film that has, even today, been absorbed in the public's eyes and minds as truth. I read a review for the upcoming Blu-ray. It was for a UK publication, and the opening paragraph of that review basically stated all the things that were false about the making of the film that had been sort of sensationalized and been following the film since the beginning. And I was kind of like, well, did you watch the documentary? Because you would have known right away that that opening statement is false. I mean, you would be, you're depending upon information that has followed the film. And, for instance, the whole idea of a hurricane coming through and the idea of the atoll sinking. Well, you know, spoiler alert on the documentary, yes, a set sunk, but it wasn't the atoll. It was a very small little slave set that was built, surprisingly and ingeniously, built on top of a large buoy. I mean, that's just, that in itself will let you know. I mean, a buoy, for people that don't know, it's just something that's anchored, you know, off the coast and is, you know, designed to deal with, you know, rough water, big waves coming in and stuff like that. So, you know, it's designed to kind of topple over, and they built, you know, these platforms and put stuntmen up on this thing. So that sunk, and it wasn't because of a hurricane. It was just because of the nature of what it was. Actually work. Yeah. But things like that have followed the film, really since its release. And even today, you ask someone about Waterworld, they're going to treat it like some kind of financial fiasco. And there's some truth to that, and there's drama in the film. I'm not saying there's not drama, but there's no more drama than I think making most motion pictures. I mean, I think some films go from concept to completion, fairly smoothly. But with something like Waterworld, filmed on water, it being this big, and it's all being an action adventure film, that, you know, today's audiences, if they're watching Waterworld, it probably won't seem so surprising, because we've been inundated with films like Waterworld. I mean, those are now major blockbusters. I was going to tell you, but anyone that read comics growing up, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, the idea of, you know, you getting a comic book movie that isn't Batman or isn't Superman, I mean, you're out of luck, because the ones that attempted, they were not so good. Yeah. And now we live in an era where, you know, comic book adaptations for books that I read, or series of comics that I read that I never thought would ever be translated to live action film, are done so successfully. So you have to kind of look at Waterworld at the era in which it was made, and kind of appreciate the time period that it was made. It's pretty ingenious.
Yeah. And also the massive scope of the film. I mean, like you said, we're used to seeing films with large scope today, but they get an awful lot of help from computers, man. I don't know. For me, it's the same sensation as, like, watching, say, Lawrence of Arabia and the assault on Aqaba. That is 1,000 extras on horseback and camel charging that fort. That isn't 1,000 CGI characters, you know, from some program designed to mimic, you know, human soldiers charging in certain directions, and they all have an AI which, you know, allows them to perform realistically. These are people. I mean, Waterworld is out there on the sea. It's, like I said, large, full-sized working vessels. All of it, like you said, the pyro alone. The atoll sequence is right up there with some of the great massive battle sequences in cinema history, and it's all real for real. It's, you know, there's no, those explosions are real, the bullet hits are real, the set is there. That's, you know, it's not a partial set, half of it's a CGI or a matte painting, it's all there. The stunts, everything. It is just such a glorious feast, and it's just so You know, I was very disheartened when people rubbished the movie. I'm still disheartened today when people rubbish the movie. There are that many articles that pop up every now and again about Waterworld, and they're usually the mockery or like a sort of almost like a sympathetic lament. Like, oh, you know, you tried so very hard, but you suck, right?
Right.
You know? And they just don't get it. They do not get it. They need their art spoon fed to them. And they wouldn't know a movie if it jumped up and bit them on the ass. But here's the thing. When you go out and they don't make pictures, you know, real for real live action pictures like this anymore, right? Granted, the scale might be huge, like Avengers, what was it, Infinity Wars or whatever, and right. like Aquaman and stuff like that. They look huge, right? They look like they're big scale, but there's a difference between seeing big scale, you know, real for real, and big scale, you know, getting the help with all the modern technology. I mean, it's like comparing apples with apples. Yeah, okay, they're both apples, but one's a little different. One's a little sweeter, a little crisper, a little, you know, a little more. I'd crawl across the desert for one more bite of that sort of thing, than something that's getting a whole lot of help from a lot of the filmmaking tools. To simply compare it to other films is ridiculous because. Like this wonderful, wonderful, incredible, invincible, awesome documentary you've made, it shows you that this type of film, the tools that were available then, the way that this film was achieved with the tools that were available then, is just, it's mastery. It's cinematic mastery. It's like, you know, you can only imagine. And we were there in the beginning. We were both there from the beginning to see this on the big screen. That's the best place to see it. Unfortunately, I haven't seen it since. Have you seen it since? Like, has it ever come back to revival? I know there's a lot of revival houses over there. Has it ever come back?
Yeah, there are, and I have. I've seen it on like revival showings with. believe it or not, I saw it doubled with The Postman, which is actually another. Another film that I really do love that I think has been unfairly judged and just so happens to be a Kevin Costner film.
Daniel, you might be my brother from another mother because, yeah, I feel the same way. But I would dearly love to see it again on the big screen. I definitely think... I know it's great to get them home and with TVs and being how they are today, it's definitely helped the cinema-going experience in the home. But I still believe certain films are really big screen movies, and there's only really one way to see them. And particularly a film like this, of the scope and the size and the scale, and the adventure and the score, and you know, it's just a wonderful movie. And I've been on podcasts before. And talked up Waterworld to the sky, and I'm doing it again. I guess, well, one last question before we wrap up. I've interviewed a lot of documentarians, wonderful documentaries just like yours, and they always, I don't know if you have any, but do you have any interesting tales, funny, bizarre or otherwise, from you know, the making of the making, you know what I mean?
Like, right, you know. Right. Well, I guess with this particular film, I think it was just more or less, you know, I don't know if anyone has ever planned to do something or thought they might do something one day in their life, and it could be anything. It could be, I'm going to put together a scrapbook of my family vacation, or that I'm going to put a scrapbook of my wedding together, or something of that effect. Well, you collect all this stuff, and you know put it away, and you carry it with you everywhere you've gone, and everywhere you've moved to, and things like that. And then, you know, when the opportunity arises, and you're able to, utilize that stuff, you have to find it. And I found that that was the most interesting thing because, you know, there was stuff that I had that I couldn't find that I ended up, luckily, I keep in touch with my, I guess my fellow projectionist when I was in high school, at the theater, we're so in touch and we both, you know, you're not supposed to do this, and I guess I'm probably saying something that is, probably not a good thing to admit to. But, you know, we kept trailers. We kept 35mm trailers because we just thought they were cool and we weren't sure if we would ever see them again. And we thought, well, one day we might be able to transfer them and we could create a little compilation of something that we could watch because we love all these trailers. And so, you know, I had the teaser trailer and the theatrical trailer for Waterworld that were unused and that hadn't been run through a projector, and I hung on to them and, you know, kept them with a lot of other film elements that I've collected throughout the years, and then eventually I ended up moving them into bins that were film specific or project specific or maybe potential project specific, and you know, I could only find the theatrical trailer, I couldn't find the teaser, and so I ended up having to reach out to the projectionist that I was friends with. He ended up having to dig around, and we ended up finding it. We were able to include it. Universal had sent standard def versions of the trailers, along with a wealth of TV spots, which all of which are included on the disc as a bonus feature. But the theatrical trailers, I was like, well, I would love to do at least a 2K transfer of the trailer and actually have an HD version of the trailer included, and the teaser trailer as well. And so we ended up, you know, finally finding them and transferring them. And, you know, so when you're looking at the disc with the bonus features, you can watch the teaser trailer in not only its flat format, but you can also see it in its matted format of 2.35:1, because that was the ratio for the Van Damme film Street Fighter. That was the aspect ratio for it. So I ended up transferring both and including both on the disc, so you can see two different versions. And when I interviewed Dean, he watching the film, he couldn't quite understand why they decided to shoot at the aspect ratio they did. I'd shown him the transfer of the trailer, the teaser trailer, as a matted scope trailer, and he was like, it looks so impressive and epic in scope, and he couldn't understand quite what the reasons for shooting it that format. But either way, I included both. So, but that was the one thing. It was kind of like I knew where it was, and you know, by the time I went to go look for it, when I was neck deep in post, I was like, where is it? I dug through everything, couldn't find it anywhere, and luckily I was able to reach out to a friend, and he ended up having them, so.
That's awesome, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see. I hadn't seen that since I was a projectionist myself. And hey, don't be self-conscious. I nicked a lot of trailers too, because, I mean, I don't know about your theater, but they used to just throw the trailers out eventually.
So, yeah, we chuck them.
I took all the stray puppies home, you know.
me and the other projectionists that work for the same company throughout the city, we every year we would do our top 10 trailers list, and right, we would like that, you know. And what we would do is we would, you know, mail them, because this is before, you know, I mean, this is before people could just send an email or anything. So we would make their list, and we would, you know, Xerox them, and we would mail them to the different theaters, and we'd all get their different list, and we would tally up, you know, the rankings, you know, based upon everyone's favorites. And I think Waterworld, the teaser trailer for Waterworld, was like number 2 of that year. I mean, it was like, everybody really responded to that teaser trailer.
Oh, totally. It was, yeah. It's just awesome. But anyway, Daniel, look, you've been very generous with your time. I can say fantastic and incredible and awesome and wonderful and superb and super and scintillating, sensational. Man, the superlatives just keep going. But, sir, what I really want to say is thank you, 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 thank you. From this Waterworld fan, for doing such a masterful job of finally giving us Waterworld fans, and I'm sure, hopefully I speak for the rest of you, giving us a definitive making of documentary dealing with Waterworld. It's Maelstrom, the Odyssey of Waterworld. The filmmaker is Daniel Griffith. Daniel, thank you for being on Podcast Them Softly, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's been really awesome. Everybody, Arrow has put out this wonderful release. It is Waterworld, three versions of the film, Maelstrom, the Odyssey of Waterworld, a fantastic booklet, Daniel Griffith and David J. Moore. It is marvelous. It's coming out on the 21st of the 1st through Arrow. Please, please, please. I'm sure all the fans are out there have got theirs on pre-order. I know I do. But for those of you listening who maybe are curious and have heard all the ridiculous press, yeah, don't listen to it. Go and check out this release. This is the best release by far that has ever come out for this movie that so many people love. If you're a first-timer, if you're a noob, if you're a novice, or, you know, because it's a seagoing film, a grommet, please do check it out. My guest has been Daniel Griffith. This is Kent Hill for Podcast Them Softly. I love Waterworld. Thank you very much.